Accession number 28417, Reel 3.
So John, you mentioned that you were appointed a sea scout at Trincomalee.
The sea scout was there in different, in two ways, a rather different sort of submarine. We had for a start the worst captain I ever served with the whole time I was in submarines. I'm a bit more merciful towards him now because he was only 24 and he just, the responsibility was, I think, too big for him. But he was a madman, putting it politely.
Captain Queeg, or?
Almost literally, a Captain Queeg. For example, I mean, this is a ridiculous example, so. One of the great, we were fed special tin food and so on in submarines. It was all meant to be balanced to keep us fit and healthy. A great delicacy was sardines. He decided that all the sardines were to be kept simply for his sole use. And he'd occasionally offer a sardine out, which he would rather choke than eat. I mean, we arrived back from one patrol with every officer under open arrest. And, you know, while we knew that when we arrived, we didn't know, but while when we eventually got back, we were all forgotten, it just increased the pressure under which we were operating. When you were actually meant to be dealing with rather more worrying things than your own captain.
Can you just explain that? What would have happened to put you under open arrest, and then how do you then continue, and what happens when you get back to Trinco?
Well, I mean, in theory, first of all, you could be put under open arrest for anything. I was put under open arrest, for example, because the captain peered through the periscope, saw what he thought was a ship anchored inshore. It was in fact a rock. Insisted that we surface and engage it with the gun. First of all, put me under open arrest for not seeing the ship, which was still think a pardonable mistake. We then surfaced, and we went in, this was off the coast of Thailand. We went in closer and closer and closer. First of all, we couldn't see what he thought was a ship. So the poor belly gun layer didn't know what to aim at, and so aimed in the wrong direction. So he was put under open arrest as well. Eventually we found out the rock that the captain wanted to engage. We then got to a stage where we were in water so shallow we couldn't have died if we were attacked. Absolute suicide, really. We continued firing and hitting the rock, and bits of the rock would fall off. There you are, you got it, you see. Eventually, when the rock stubbornly refused to sink, I think we'd done enough damage there, to which we all agreed. And he then turned around and went back and we died. Now that was a sort of thing. I mean, and then he insisted that the report was falsified, and we all refused to type it. So he had to type his own report. And his report said engaged
static object.
Not even that clever. No, engaged enemy freighter anchored at. I mean, it was absolutely grotesque. But still, I don't particularly want to recall for posterity these rather depressing stories, but we did, in fact, when we eventually got back to the depot ship, the first lieutenant, who was a splendid fellow called John Davies, and I was a supernumerary third hand, as I was the only one who had had any operating experience. We lined up to see the commander of submarines in the depot ship and told him what was going on, and asked if we could have a replacement captain, and there weren't any. So the commander of submarines said, "I'm sorry, I'll listen very carefully to any adverse reports I get on you all, but I can't give you a replacement." So that was it. So we were stuck, in addition to everything else, having virtually had a mutiny. And they were, I mean, we were very close. But to give you some idea, and I mean, now this seems so childish, when we eventually sailed back from the Far East, when the war had ended, and we'd gone into Hong Kong and released Hong Kong, Sea Scout was ordered home. And the whole way from Hong Kong back to Blockhurst, the submarine headquarters in Portsmouth, none of us spoke to the captain except to answer a question, and then with the minimum of words. So he held him in Coventry for really 3 months. I mean, you know, you get, although the wardroom had no bloody room in it, none of us were sitting in the wardroom with him. I was a signal officer. I used to go and sit in the little wireless room.
What was the effect on the sailors? The other 40 of the crew, give or take.
Well, they didn't like him, but I think they had some sympathy with us.
I was thinking of...
I mean, certainly, I still am friends with a couple of the sailors aboard that submarine.
I was thinking of competence and coherence of as a team.
It doesn't happen in a submarine, because in a submarine, you depend on each other. And you know you depend on each other. And in a way, the more we had a common enemy, you know, we sat together more and more.
And so this man was only replaced when you got back to Portsmouth?
Yeah.
And you were with him how long, Sir John? Must have been at least a year.
Oh, more than a year. Yes, more than a year. I think I joined Sea Scout in the spring of 43. And I
suppose. Spring of 44, possibly?
44, no. Yes, I suppose spring 44. And I arrived back when the war was over, in 46.
Yes.
But anyway, The Far East patrols were much more difficult, because first of all you had very long passages. I mean, although we started off the Andaman Islands, you know, just getting across the Indian Ocean was something like 8 or 9 days across each way.
All on the surface, of course.
Yeah, and not too risky. I mean, you had to keep a bloody good eye open. But there wasn't much in the way of aircraft at that time on that side.
They would have operated out of Malaya against you,
yeah,
or something,
yes,
like that.
The Andamans, there was a dense traffic there because they were trying to supply virtually all their forces in Burma along the sea. And so we were continuously shooting up little kikes and, well, not kikes, but we used to board a lot of them and seek them with demolition charges and that sort of thing. That was quite
What did you do with the local crews? Had to put them
we back? Either used to take them on, we never abandoned them, but we used to either take them on board until we found one we didn't want to sink and put them all on board and tell them to take them home. Or we used to occasionally had a little boat or something. We cram them into the boat, wait until we got them close to the shore and then offload them.
Of course, they could then say that you were in the vicinity, which would always be a danger.
Yeah, but that was... but, I mean, we were known to be operating all over that particular sea. After two or three patrols there, then we were told to do a slingshot patrol. We did a patrol there and then left them and went down to Perth in Australia, where our deputy ship had moved. And that was a heavenly place to be, of course. Real live white women, and fruit and wine and everything. And we then operated from Perth off Indonesia for two or three patrols. That was an interesting place to operate because we had to go the whole way up the coast of Australia, and we used to refuel at a place called Exmouth Gulf, which I've been back to many times since. Now, the most fabulous seafood place. And there were a tiny little tanker with a half-crazed American crew who would top up your diesel. And then you'd leave there and go on up and get in to... we used to go through the Sunda Straits or the Lombok Straits. And they were fairly hairy because they were long sea straits. And the Japanese knew that was the only way we could get in to the other coast of Indonesia. So they used to attack us very heavily. In fact, on one occasion, we were down for nearly 20 hours, which is the longest I'd ever done. And when we surfaced, I was a surfacing officer with the captain, the air from the submarine came up black. But...
you had no way, of course, of cleaning it, did you?
No. So now, in those days, we had, I think, two bottles of oxygen, which you could release a bit into the air. But, I mean, bloody useless.
I'm surprised there weren't CO2 scrubbers or something.
No, in those days. You see, we were there much... we were essentially pre-war submarines. And all that, I mean, we didn't even end the war with a snorkel. And indeed, the very first submarine I ever joined, for a training submarine, was an H-class submarine that was operating in the First World War. Anyway, we then shifted sadly from Perth and went up to the Philippines and operated from Cebu Bay off the coast of Thailand. And they were very difficult because the patrols, unless you were lucky and you fired all your armor, were 3 months. And 3 months was really heavy. I mean, what we had done was we'd filled all the saddle tanks up with fuel, and so we could go fuel-wise a hell of a long way. But everything else ran out after about a week. I mean, fresh food of any sort had run out. Everything was tinned or dehydrated. Not much of a range of dehydrated stuff. Nothing fresh of any sort. Sweltering heat, because again, a submarine takes the temperature, in those days, took the temperature of the water outside. And so when you dived, you were absolutely sweating. Submarines were infested with cockroaches. I mean, when one used to turn in, you'd wake up covered in bloody cockroaches crawling all over you. And again, our captain, bless him, believed that we shouldn't work more than 2 hours watches. And now this was fine, but you did 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So most you ever got to sleep was about an hour and a half, because you have 15 minutes turning in and 15 minutes getting up ready for your watch. And you try doing a maximum an hour and a half sleep every in a single wallop for 3 months, and it really does absolutely fuck you. But anyway, what else? When we went to Subic, we were then doing these 3 month patrols off Thailand, and we were on our second when, thank God, the atom bomb was dropped. And I didn't know anybody. We were in within about a week of the landings in Malaya, which would have been absolutely horrific.
This was the Operation Zipper.
Yeah. And thank God it never happened, because the planning was wrong and the intelligence was wonky. And no doubt the Japanese would have fought, as they always did. But one of the things in the submarines in the Far East was, we believed, we were not right, we found out subsequently, but we believed that the Japanese never took or kept a submarine prisoner. Now, in fact, we were wrong, because there were about a dozen that, for some reason or other, they hadn't knocked off. But we were all absolutely bloody terrified of being captured. Never minded dying. One of the great attractions of submarines, and one of the reasons I did join, was because you virtually never had anybody wounded in a submarine. And one of the nasty things is if you are, in fact, in an operation and you have a lot of wounded on board and the ship gets sunk, you know, there's nothing really you can do for them, and their conditions are appalling. And I would always far prefer to have been go, bang, than be in pain and agony and all the rest. Again, particularly in front of all your mates. Anyway, is that all enough for the war? Or?
Yes, I'm very happy with what this marvellous story that you've told, yes.
Okay, well, when the war ended, and we got back to Blockhouse.
In the spring of 46.
Yeah. Well, I think it was actually autumn 45.
Autumn 45.
When we got there, the other officers all left, and I was left with to pay off the sea scum. And I was then appointed to another submarine which was running out of Blockhouse. And I must say, this was an eye-opener, because the ship's company were, again, pressed men, as all our sailors had been. But all the wartime sailors had been demobbed. And these were doing national service they didn't want to do. They were put into submarines which they didn't want to be in. They didn't appreciate how dangerous submarines are intrinsically. So you didn't have the same spirit at all. And I had more near accidents in the first 3 months of peace than I'd had during the whole war, including being depth charged and all the rest of it. And I remember on one particular occasion, our crew had done the usual thing, and we dived. And one of the things when you dive is everybody who has to shut up and then has to say the vent is shut out loud. And some clown had said he'd shut the vent, and he hadn't. So we went down, of course, the submarine filled up with about a ton of water, and went straight down to the bottom, was stopped when we eventually hit the bottom.
What depth were you?
Oh, about 150 feet. And at that depth, it takes forever to pump the water out.
Because of the outside pressure.
Yeah. So anyway, then we were pumping the water out, and I had to walk into the wardroom. And there was Admiralty Fleet Order, who said, volunteers required to learn Russian at Cambridge University. And I, at that moment, would have learned, volunteered to learn Swahili if they got me out. So, I almost before we surfaced, or eventually got up to the surface, wrote my application. And to my amazement, I was accepted. I assume because of my literary alpha and my other languages. I was then sent to Cambridge, where we were told to learn Russian in 3 months, because all the Russian speakers in the Navy had been RNVR officers and had all retired. But when we went to learn Russian, none of us had any intention whatsoever of learning Russian, except Edward Ashmore, who knew it already. But the rest of us found to our horror that the lady professor was competing for the commission to teach all the services Russian. So it was a battle of wills, and by God, she was a tough old bean. A fantastic woman called Elizabeth Hill, who got married for the first time at the age of 92 and left her toy boy husband, who when she was 92 was 87, but she figured he wasn't any bloody use about 5 years later. But anyway, Lisa, who I loved dearly, was absolutely determined to get us through. So after 3 months, I found myself passing, after a fashion, the interpreter's exam, and I was then appointed as a Russian interpreter in Germany to pack up Wilhelmshaven Dockyard. And I was the liaison with a Russian crew and also doing the counter-espionage with them. And that was...
You were doing counter-espionage?
Against... Well, the Russian mission were, of course, espionaging like mad.
Yes.
And I was designed or empowered to do what I could to stop them.
Right.
So I was in charge of this vast dockyard, which was being shipped piece by single piece right down to lavatory brushes and railway lines to be reassembled in Russia. And it was already apparent to us that, or in my simple terms, the evil was... The Nazis had been replaced instantly
by a new one.
By the evil of the Russians themselves. And I was extraordinarily fortunate in my job there, because my MVD, opposite number, got the clap. And he also, of course, the Russians were strictly forbidden to cohabit in any way
With the Germans,
and this was irrefutable evidence that he had been. And of course, commentary on the Russians at that time, he didn't dare tell anybody on his side to be treated. So he came to see me and asked for help. So I then got our doctor to treat him, and meanwhile took wonderful close-ups of the member and the evidence and everything else. And from then on, of course, he had to collaborate with me rather than anything else. So I was able to prevent them doing any evil, and also...
They were entitled to dismantle the dockyard under the post-war agreement, so to speak, between, of course, nothing to do with Germany, between the Allies and the Soviets.
Yeah.
What were they seeking to spy on in addition to... What were they seeking to do there?
Oh, well, us. They wanted to find out everything that we were doing, any piece of information we had. They wanted to, in fact, ensure... They believed that we were totally at war with them. They really did. I mean, when we used to have an officer's dance with a local soldiery, they would be convinced that they were carrying out operations, you know, to test them, and pretty useless. But on the other hand, of course, they were. I mean, again, the interesting thing to me was how totally inept the Russians were. I mean, one of the things I used to have to do was to organize their ships alongside and loaded with the bits from the dockyard. I knew all the sea transport officers the whole way up the coast and the Baltic. And I used to bring them up and ask them. And the one thing one knew is if they said, I can assure you, John, there'll be no ship for another week, you'd immediately get the berthing crews up because the bloody thing would be steaming in through the bloody entrance. I mean, they really had no... And they would ring up again. I used to ring up the sea transport officer in Russia, you know, somewhere like Riga. And the phone would answer eventually, and he'd say, I'm sorry, you can't speak to so-and-so, he's drunk. You say, well, how long has he been drunk? 2 days. And, you know, literally, no perfectly reasonable excuse. Why the hell did anybody expect that he wouldn't be drunk? Anyway, I'd worked with them, or with them, against them, for about 8 months. And I was suddenly hauled on to go back to the UK to report to the Naval Intelligence Division, which I did. And the guy who was my eminence grise for some years was Commander Courtney. And he had been the person who'd run the first, recruited the first Russian-speaking course, was in charge of Russian and Russian affairs for the Navy. And he wanted me to go and take on a job in the cabinet offices, which I did. And the job proved to be the deception job, proved to be the double cross committee and all that sort of thing. And there were three of us, one from the Navy, one from the Army, and one from the RAF. And I was the only person who knew the Russians and spoke Russian. And that was fascinating. I worked there for 2 years and saw at first hand all my wartime heroes. The first Sea Lord then was Bruce Fraser. Montgomery was the chief of the Army staff. Portal was still in the RAF. And Bevan, Ashley, I worked to all of them, saw them all close to. And that was the phase of which I suddenly discovered that really they weren't the supermen. And my whole view of the British system changed fundamentally. And I realized that the British system is run almost entirely bottom up. And what you depend on is a very high quality of junior people.
And you don't think we have that today, do you? That they are, that we have...
Junior people are not trusted anymore.
Yes.
Are not developed and not trained. And the whole thing depends on trust above everything else. Trust and high demands.
I get the impression that no one's allowed any responsibility.
That's right.
Everything is a pre-programmed set of rules you have to follow.
Yeah, that's right. And this doesn't grow people at all. It doesn't grow people, and it means that decisions are always taken at the point of maximum unknowledge, and again, any initiative or imagination or creativity is stifled. And I think this is where we've gone wrong.
How many times did you meet the then First Sea Lord, Bruce Payson?
Well, I knew him actually faintly. Well, he was a sort of honorary uncle. He'd known, had gone and spent his leaves when he was in the East Indies with my father and mother. And he'd been a sort of family friend. I remember the family and the Maharaja were invited aboard the Courageous for the Naval Review, which was commanded by him at that time. And so I had seen him from time to time. And he had also been the Admiral on the Duke of York when I, during the 3 months I was there. So I knew him faintly. I'd liked him, but I never thought of him as a sort of... You know, my picture has been, and you know what nonsense it is, but the Chiefs of Staff, I used to picture walking around a room saying,